The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, for this evening, I don't have a lot on my mind to talk about, and which is a blessing, isn't it? For me, at least. But I have this to say, and then maybe we could turn it over to see what kind of questions or discussion you'd like to have. I'm fond of the image of painting with watercolors, trying to make a beautiful painting with watercolors, with your brush and your watercolors and your water and everything. You dip the brush in the water and the watercolors, and then you try to paint on a flowing stream. Doesn't work very well, does it? It could be fun, I imagine, but you don't, you know, the image doesn't stay at all. And so when is it that our life, our efforts are kind of like that, where we're trying to do something, make something, but, you know, reality is just a flowing stream, and it just dissolves right away. And one area that I think that is our preoccupation with the past. The past is actually more ephemeral than the running stream, but where is the past? And I find it amazing still to this day at how the past disappears. It just, you know, I could, what happens early in the day before, minute before, a year before, 10 years before. It's not here. It's in a memory, or a collective memory of people who remember. But I'm amazed that, not so much at how this disappears, but how the mind, awareness, can be empty of it, or free of it, or clear of it. Something that at the moment seemed very intense, perhaps, very involved, maybe even very difficult, maybe a lot of emotions connected to it, that you know, once it's gone, later in the day when you're doing something else, where is it? Where is it? You know, it's, you know, you know, in a sense, where it is at that point, in many ways, is in the memory. And the memories are so, it's like painting on, you know, memories are like painting on flowing streams. Generally, we have to keep painting. You know, very fast. If we want to try to have some semblance of, you know, holding on to the past or gripping to the past or something. Or it's like the future. You know, the future doesn't exist. And we paint a future for ourselves. And then we somehow inhabit the painting that we made. But the painting is like just flimsy. The painting is just, you know, just painting on flowing stream. How many times have you painted a future and tried to inhabit it, but it never happened that way? I've been, you know, amazed. I was a very slow learner because I had to plan a future, plan for later in the day or the next day or next week or something. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of times in my life. Before it finally dawned on me what a poor record of predicting the future I had. Amazingly poor record. But you know, I'd never kept tabs. So each time seemed so important, so consequential, so meaningful, and you know, each time was, you know, was just this time, so it seemed like important. But when I finally stopped and thought about my success record in planning the future, I had to admit I was abysmally poor. And that helped me a lot, because then I realized that since it's probably not going to happen the way I anticipate, maybe I don't have to be so apprehensive for what is going to happen. Because my thing was I was mostly afraid of the future, afraid of what was going to happen, so I was trying to get everything lined up ahead of time or something, or figure it all out ahead of time. And then I'd have it all figured out, then it would happen differently. And it happened so differently that after a while I thought, you know, it's really a waste of time. You know, to do all this high-end planning when it doesn't, you know, not going to work out that way. And so that helped loosen up my grip of the future that I had. So painting, you know, somehow painting on a flowing stream. And then we have that's the past and the future, and then we have the present moment. And the present moment certainly is realer than the past and the future. I mean, the past is kind of like just memory, thoughts, images. And the future is just a virtual reality. I guess they're both kind of virtual. But the present, you know, that's not so virtual, right? That's real, the present. And the present moment's pretty interesting, too. And the image, or the image, but the analogy that's maybe comparable to the painting on flowing stream for the present is a musical note. You pluck the guitar, and a musical note travels through the air. The musical note is only in the present moment when you hear it, when it comes, when it's made. And you can't grasp it. Have you any of you tried to grab a hold? You know, you hear a beautiful piece of music and you try to, like, you know, I guess you can go, you know, to iTunes and download it onto your computer. And now have that memory. That's more solid than your memory. More accurate, too. But you know, the present moment exists kind of like the note traveling through space. You can't hold on to it. It's there, it's gone. Does it have any hard edges? Is it, you know, what is this present moment? An amazing thing happens when people do, generally this happens in retreats, but when people's concentration is quite strong in meditation. The task of meditation and mindfulness is to be really present, to be notice what's happening in the present moment, to recognize what's happening as it's happening. So the idea is to be in the present moment. That's like the goal, being, you know, great ideal we set ourselves up to do. And I'm championing, let's be in the present moment. But the amazing thing, at some point when the concentration is strong, you're really looking very, very precisely. I mean, you're like, you have the mind's eye is like a magnifying glass on reality. You know what happens? You never get to the present moment. You can't, you know, you can never actually realize you can never be in it in terms of your cognition and your recognition in your mind. I mean, you're always here. Where else would you be? But you can never actually know the present. You can only know what just happened. It's like only a moment before, perhaps, or less, half a moment before. But all you could do is know is what just happened. And so this is probably why the Buddha, when he talked about the very famous Buddhist expression of things as they are, have you heard that expression? We're supposed to see things as they are. The Buddha didn't actually, the grammar of that phrase is usually mistranslated, mistranslated as things as they are. Rather, the way the original Pali, in the original language, the way it's structured, the word is yata bhuta. It's a past participle. And so it should be translated as things as they've come to be. But that's a mouthful. So they say things as they are. And the difference between things as they are and things as they come to be is that it's a process of coming to be, and you only know it after it's come to be, for the moment it's there. It's kind of like you're always slightly behind. You can't quite get to the present. So now, you know, you can, I guess some of you are going to sue me for false advertisement. You can come and learn mindfulness and be in the present moment. Now you know you can't. So where does that put you? Future, past. It's all ephemeral. It's all so fleeting. It's all so light. And it certainly doesn't feel that way when our life seems so consequential, so substantial, so meaningful. Such profoundly important or difficult things happen to us. And some of them are important. A lot of things are important. And I don't want to dismiss the importance of things. But they're also quite fleeting. And reality itself is quite light. And what makes it heavy is not reality, but what makes it heavy is the way that we choose, it doesn't seem like we've chosen it, but the way we've chosen to relate to reality, how we take it on, how we inhabit it, how we latch on, really, resist it. The thoughts that we chase after, the thoughts that we hold on to, the thoughts that we spin around and around and around and tell ourselves stories and events. I think it's quite amazing. I'm kind of amazed by this world that I live in. And I'm amazed that I could sit down to meditate today. And the very full day that I had, it was so full and the time's challenging and the things I had to do. It's gone. gone. Until tomorrow, I'm going to have to go back into that world. But for now, it's just, you know, gone. Jack Kornfield talks sometimes about the past being gone. He said, oh, it's gone. Where has it gone to? It's gone to the same place as the pyramids or the pharaohs or all these, Napoleon and Cleopatra. All these things gone. So, you've had your day today. I don't know what kind of day you had. And part of your day was to come here. And I don't know if your experience of sitting here meditating freed you from your day, or whether you brought your day with you throughout the 45 minutes. It chased after you, or you chased after it. It's more like you chase after it, right? Because it's gone. It's like water It's really like water on this flowing river, unless we're relating to it in some way. If we're feeding it, involved in it, concerned with it, preoccupied with it, we stay involved and involved. And the important task of mindfulness meditation, Buddhist meditation, is really, it's not to be in the present moment. The important task is to understand that relationship, to understand what are we doing that causes us to hold on or grasp on or resist or kind of make things solid, make things substantial. How do we not allow for the flow of life to move through us in such a way that we can be fresh, that we can not be held back or held down by what has happened? So those are my few little words. So now it's your turn. What are we going to do with the rest of our time? Yes. Can we have the mic? Yeah, it's coming.
Hello, Gil. It's very appropriate for me to ask. I'm often bugged by regret, and I would like to ask you if you wouldn't. I think you said many of the things that I could use if you ask me to take some of the things you said and apply them to regret, because it's part of the past, but you know, you never use the word. I wonder if you could reformulate some of the things you said, aiming them at specifically regret. And I'll just confess one of the things that I regret, because it's like many of the people in this room, the country's financial condition isn't good, my financial position isn't good. And I'm sure there are more than a million people in the United States regretting that they didn't sell all their holdings when it was way up there, okay? And it just plagues me, Gil. And could you just say apply some of the words you just applied to this silly regret that I have, and I just can't get rid of it.
Financial regret.
Coulda, shoulda, woulda. You know, we all know coulda, shoulda, woulda. Okay.
How about if I suggest this to you? Let's do a little kind of exploring this word of this regret thing. If I suggest that the issue is, the problem is not regret. I think it can be healthy to have regret. I have regret about some of the things I've done in my life. I've done things that's caused, that hurts people, for example. And I, those memories come back, I regret having done those. And sometimes I feel a little bit lousy if, you know, certain things. Like, wow, I did that, that's too bad. And I feel it's appropriate for me to feel kind of, it seems right. I mean, I wouldn't want to kind of, you know, start laughing. Well, it was great that I did that, you know. It's too, you know, but it's too bad for that person, but it was kind of, you know. But I think regret is not, you know, I think it's healthy to have a capacity for a certain kind of regret. So if we take that as a premise, if your suffering is not your regret, what is the suffering you're feeling around the regret?
Sadness.
Loss. So there's loss, grief. So anything else associated with it? It's in the orbit around that regret.
Some self-deprecation. You know, why wasn't I smart enough to? So. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
You were kind of stupid.
Yeah.
I didn't listen to people. You know, there was a person who I had dinner with, and he just spent the whole dinner saying how ridiculous the price of stocks were at the time. Okay.
So
I'm saying, why didn't I listen to him?
Uh-huh. So it's not so much. So your part of it is the barbs you're sending to yourself.
Part of it.
Where you're criticizing yourself in some kind of way, being stupid and variety of things. And then there's also the grief and the loss. I mean, some people have made financial decisions. I don't know if they were good or bad, but financial decisions that turned out not to have been productive or worse. They lost a lot of money. And so there's sadness and loss there. So could it be for you, I don't know your situation well enough, but could it be for you that part of your task is not to let go of the regret, keep the regret and learn from it, but rather to process your grief, really kind of understand your grief. Maybe it's unprocessed and the grief, sadness has to be moved through you. And that your task is to understand the way that you relate to yourself, the self-concept you have, the attitude you have toward yourself, that would bring you to be so, have such strong self-recrimination. And because that's probably something you're liable to do again in other situations. And if you could address that and free yourself from condemnation, self-condemnation, that's a portable skill that in the future when you do something very different that you might regret doing, then at least you're not going to add the suffering of the self-criticism on top of it. You know, so maybe the more interesting question for you is not how to work with regret, but how to work with these other two, the grief and the self-criticism. What do you think of that? Does that seem?
In a sense, it gets rid of the regret because, and I don't have to start looking at the regret anymore, but something else, the sadness. So the next time I'm here, I'll ask another question about
the sadness. Is there someone else?
Just opening my mouth. I've really enjoyed this discussion, I have to say. So thank you for your talk. just on the last topic, I'm pretty much in the same boat. And one thing I love financially, that is, I've had a lot of bad decisions and so forth. And but one thing I like about Buddhism is that it, at least for me, it teaches that, you know, what happens to me is my responsibility. And the experience comes from sort of past karma, not from grasping. And so if, you know, my financial ups and downs in this lifetime probably relate to things that happened from a Buddhist point of view long ago, and I don't have much control over it, but if I want to be financially secure in the future, I should practice generosity. But the other thing is, the subject of time, I think, is fascinating, and I love to read popular physics books.
Physics?
Yeah. Because I'm sort of interested, but I don't really understand it, but I like to think about it. And there's some fascinating discussion of the flow of time, so-called flow of time, in some popular physics book written by a guy, Brian Greene. And he points out that there isn't in physics any flow of time in physics. You know, the laws don't have a flow of time in them, the past and the future. That's all in perception. And he even quotes Einstein as saying, you know, the problem of the now worried him a lot because there isn't any physical explanation for it. In fact, the point you made about our experience of now being everything that's on our now list, you know, everything we perceive has already happened, and the other, it's happened at different times depending on how far away it is from the stars to up close. So some of the stuff that we perceive has happened a long time ago. It's a mixture, and then everybody's now is different. So anyway, I just wanted to say that it is fascinating to think about the mind, how it's so unique and. There's really no good explanation for it.
thank you. Someone else wants to offer something? Ask a question? Yep, on the stage.
My obsession is more with the future of wanting to be so thoughtful and so helpful as some people in the helping professions get. They want to be, you know, that sense if you've been helpful before, thoughtful, that you want to always be ahead of someone else maybe and be able to be really present for whatever's happening for them. So I'm working on more.
So you're not present for yourself,
not
because
present for myself.
Because you're present for them in the future.
Exactly. Exactly. So working more on that trusting that you can be present for yourself as well as be present for others is something that I'm working on. So I wondered if you could say a few things about that.
So the trust that you can be present for yourself and present for others at the same time, or just appropriately present for yourself when that's appropriate, present for yourself when that's appropriate, and present for others when that's appropriate? What kind of present?
That's even a question, is can you really be kind of present and sincere and kind of totally there for yourself as well as for others? Because I find myself getting lost in being so present for others that I'm like, wait, where am I?
Uh-huh. I don't have, you know, it's a great question. And myself, I don't have any kind of ability to have a fixed answer for you. You know, as opposed what's the appropriate balance between paying attention to oneself and paying attention to someone else? However, I think that if the task of mindfulness is to notice where the suffering is, and if you're attentive to suffering, you'll notice if you're too involved in others or too involved in yourself or not enough involved with others, or not enough involved with yourself, because chances are that there has to be some way, you use the word obsession, but some kind of contraction, some kind of tightness, something we're grasping onto when the self-other balance is out of balance. And if you use suffering as your guideline, and one of the great ways for doing that is to pay attention to your body. Your body is a great truth teller. And if you can stay connected to your body, then you'll notice whether somehow you're leaning too far into the other person or leaning too far back or not available. You're tightened up, you're resisting the world, or you're kind of latched on into someone else. And the body is a great balancer. It will help you find the balance. And so that, and then if you have this openness in your body, this greater freedom in the mind, and paying attention to suffering as the guide, then you can be much more fluid. And there are times when, at different levels of kind of the mind, there are times when you give a lot of attention to other people. You might spend weeks paying attention to, you know, an elderly parent who's, you know, in the last stages of life, and that's yet you don't count. It's like a new parent. It's one of the big surprises for me when I was a new parent was I no longer counted. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning. And before I would say, "My sleep, leave me alone." And you know, the baby is crying. You don't say, "Leave me alone." I need my beauty sleep. I don't count anymore. And it felt beautiful. It felt kind of liberating. I didn't realize there was a certain kind of self preoccupation that I had, even after all my Buddhist years of training, that I kind of was freed from when I had a child. But then it was also surprising, as my kid got older, it was no longer appropriate for me to give myself up in the same way for him. And if I kept doing it that way, that was appropriate for a baby, I kept doing that way when he got older, it was no longer a healthy parent-child relationship. And so at some point, it had to shift, and I had to count more in a certain kind of way, or my needs, or my situation. So there has to be this fluidity to move back and forth. Sometimes we give our all to someone else, sometimes we give very little to someone else. Sometimes our needs are so great, it's not appropriate to pay attention to someone else. And so how to be fluid with it and is really the big task. And the lack of fluidity is one of the guidelines. So rather than setting up fluidity as the goal, the practice is to notice where you're stuck and then learn to unstuck it and then let yourself then discover the natural fluidity. And the reason for that is that, I find that if we take this spectrum between bringing attention to others and bringing attention to oneself, it's a very long kind of spectrum, and we're flowing back and forth all the time. And sometimes we're well stationed in the middle, and it's very kind of half and half, and sometimes it flows back and forth in a fluid way, and I can't calculate exactly where it should be, and so I'm constantly going back and forth. But one of the really beautiful experiences to have is to do that flowing back and forth without any sense of there being a boundary here. There's, in a sense, you can have the experience of even the idea of self and other disappear. And so it's really fluid, because then it's not like you're paying attention to yourself, it's just awareness is open in all directions, inside and outside. And so it's not like you're self-preoccupied or other preoccupied, but it's just open. And so you might be equally aware of your own thoughts and feelings as you are the situation of the person you're talking to. So does this at all speak to what your question was? Or am I going on and on?
No, it does.
Losing touch with you.
No, I just find myself stuck in sort of a one or the other. I'm like, whoa, I'm way out there, or oh, I'm way held back. So I just find myself noticing that I'm often not feeling the fluidity. I'm feeling that I'm like, oop, I'm way over there. Oop, I'm way back here.
Are you like a pendulum that swings?
It feels a little bit like that.
So you're
like there's not a great enough ease. I'm wanting a greater ease and a greater sense of balance, but I think maybe I've been more obsessed with trying to find that balance. Like, am I really centered? Am I really, maybe instead of just having
Oh, you shouldn't come around IMC. It's kind of one of the problems with Buddhism. It's a little bit oppressive to be around these Buddhist scene where people think I'm supposed to be balanced and centered, and you know, how am I going to do that? And you know, and then you come to IMC, and you know, all these balanced, centered people. Now I got to be that way, and it's kind of a headache. It's better just to study what you do. Notice what you do. Notice what prompts you to go to the extremes of one end and then ricochet to the other end, and understand yourself better. And sometimes it's better not to go after some ideal like being centered and balanced. It's sometimes better to study what's actually happening that makes you uncentered. And if you understand that really well, then maybe you'll find the natural balance, natural center. And that natural center balance is going to be fluid, it's going to change what that means at different times. Does that make sense? So. Okay, do we have time for one more? Yes, please, if you could wait for that mic.
I wake up feeling anxious.
You wake up feeling anxious.
It's like all the things I didn't do yesterday that I have to do today, and I feel like I'm always behind. And I don't know. I have a whole bunch of little daily meditation books, you know.
This has been going on for a long time for you?
It's kind of recent, I guess. I don't know.
When did it begin?
I don't know. Sorry.
It's okay.
I don't know. I have an 89-year-old mother, and that's part of it.
So you can't do enough?
Pardon me?
And you can't do enough.
Well, I'm not caregiving. I mean, she has two caregivers, but I'm still obviously involved. Uh-huh. But it's like there's so many things that I'm not doing. It's just, it's crazy. It's like I feel like I'm so far behind, and I can't. So how do I deal with it?
Yeah, it's hard. You know, they say that, there's a lot of publicity these days about how many people in America are depressed. And they say that actually there's more people who are anxious than there are people who are depressed. It's an epidemic issue in our society. And some of it comes from our society's messages about all the things we're supposed to do and how we're supposed to be proper and get everything done. And so some of that might be you've internalized things, messages that are impossible to live up to. So there's two real approaches for you, I think. You know, one is to learn to relax. And that's a really important art. It's not an easy one. And especially when there's these strong authoritative voices inside that says that you can't relax. You're supposed to be anxious. So, but it's really good to relax. It gives a good perspective. The other is trying to understand what those forces are inside of you. What's going on inside that prompts you to be anxious? Some people find that when they wake up anxious in the morning, that it's an indication that the inner psychological forces are much deeper than even the usual conscious mind, which usually we're aware of consciously. And so sometimes you need help from someone like a therapist who can really kind of explore the terrain with you to understand what's actually going on, what's the underlying belief systems, values that are going on, what the background you have. And it's a beautiful thing to do because it's beautiful because it has to be done. and it can be done. So in this kind of context, that's all I want to say now. But I hope that my hope is for people like you in your shoes that the message, the practice and the message and teachings of mindfulness and Buddhism will give you hope that it's possible to work through the issues of anxiety. It takes time. It takes some courage. So, yes. Would I say that animals are a cow? So is an animal mindful, like a cow mindful? Can you define mindfulness then? Uh-huh. So So they're not involved in the past.
They're not preoccupied with it, I don't think. Who knows, right? Yeah. But they seem present. They seem present in the moment. I just wondered if the Buddha had.
I have a story in my new book. In my book of stories, I don't know if some of you have seen it, but I have a story in there. Something like, there's this mother who goes to the abbess and complains about a traveling Buddhist teacher who says that all you have to do is be in the present moment. And she says to the abbess, you know, I don't get this because my kids are only in the present moment. And they're completely in the here and now when I'm trying to get them to school. And they, they're completely absorbed in the snail walking along the path outside our home, and not realizing we have to get to school. You know, I'm the only one who's supposed to carry the future and what has to happen, and you know they're gonna be late for school. So children have an amazing capacity to be present, but they don't have a capacity to understand how they cling. And how to let go of that clinging. And so cows, I don't know if cows cling. But they certainly are afraid. They can get very afraid. I've seen cows when I used to work on a dairy farm. If there was a wheelbarrow in the path they usually walk every day, they'd be petrified. The wheelbarrow was just a frightening thing. But mindfulness is not just being in the present moment. Mindfulness has a lot to do with a heightened recognition of what's actually going on in the present moment. That it's all closely akin, when it's well developed, it's closely related to wisdom. And I don't think that animals, most animals at least, have the capacity to understand the deeper truths, the deeper deeper insights of reality. That give us wisdom and give us freedom. They might be very present, and one of the reasons why we need to have that heightened sense of awareness and recognition and wisdom is that we have a much higher also capacity for clinging than seemingly most animals. Animals have a capacity for fear and greed and all the kind of usual emotions that we have. Some animals do. But they don't seem to hold on to them as long as humans do. They might be afraid when there's reason to be afraid, and then 5 minutes later, it seems like they're pretty relaxed again. And not only do we humans get afraid and then stay afraid, we have an amazing capacity to be afraid of things that don't exist. And they say the difference between fear and anxiety is that fear is about real things. Anxiety is about imaginary things. And so the question for all of you is, how much is your fear about imaginary things? Anticipatory fear. Oh.
I have a housekeeper, and she was always worried about things that would happen in the future. So I said gently to her one day, "Hey, you know, those things haven't happened yet. They're not real yet." And I think that made an impact with her because she was better after that.
Beautiful. So thank you for sharing these present moments together, and they're already gone. I certainly appreciate it being together and sitting with you, and may your week be one of fluidity. Thank you.